Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast. Go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, as in, go ahead, make my news. And make a donation, or preferably, if you can subscribe and donate on a regular basis, just a few dollars a month or what have you, it keeps this little operation going here. This is a unique way of doing things. It's sort of like a business slash charity slash exposing scumbaggery. I don't know how much success it's going to have in the future. I'm just kind of pioneering this new model. My theory is that if I do a hell of a lot of good for a hell of a lot of people, that a few people, just a few, will do something good for me so that I can just keep doing it. That's my theory. I may be proven wrong in time, but this is the third plus year of the Vinnie Eastwood Show using this model, and it's only gotten bigger and better thanks to the relatively small number, considering the listening audience that I have in terms of visits to the website, who contribute, who actually value this show that they don't have to pay for enough to give something out of the kindness of their hearts. And I want to iterate just how freaking grateful I am just for the opportunity to spend 5 days a week exposing scumbaggery for the betterment of humanity. It is a privilege. It is a privilege, and I am honored that anybody would even come out to support me in such a way. And so many of these donations that I have received, because I'm working so hard, I don't even have enough time to send you all emails back to thank you personally for donating to me from the bottom of my heart. I don't even have the time to do that, and I feel really guilty about it. And I want to iterate to anybody who listens to this radio broadcast on a regular basis who has contributed that I have not thanked. Thank you very much. I couldn't do it without you. Now, Kevin Galilee is my guest. Kevin, do you have a website there?
Yes, not a personal website anymore, because as you well know, I've been in prison 6 times over the past 3 years, and my entire financial independence has been destroyed, and with it, my previous websites. But I do have several. I'm using the social media, and I several outfits support my work, and they have dedicated pages to me. And I will give you a list that you can post along with the archived interview when you are done. It's a list of about 6 or 7 websites that carry my work and my publications and my profile and my history, because it is quite a colorful history in the meantime. One that I suspect sooner or later will make into a Hollywood movie. It has been that exciting and that crazy over the past 4 years. And it is a miracle that I'm still standing here and I have come through this unscathed. But since I have earned the right to speak freely and to say things that nobody in government can, or nobody in the who's part of the international superstructure can, I am going to make full use of that. Before I continue with my subject, I just want to say that what you are doing, Vinny, is absolutely invaluable, and I hope that your listeners will support you accordingly, because you deserve it. You have opened new avenues for me, and actually, you should know that shortly after you interviewed me in November, I was approached by the Civil Rights Party of Canada, and they have offered me the second highest position within the party as a deputy prime minister in waiting. And I've accepted it, but not only have they done that, they have fully adopted my own principles. And of course, I probably would not have come to their attention had it not been for your interview. Your interview has contributed to that, has brought me into the public eye, and has resulted in other interviews here in Canada. So it's you have broken the ice for me in New Zealand, and I'm Canadian. And Canada has learned from you And it is only because you broke the ice and let out this, you know, this huge cat out of the bag, so to say, that others in Canada had the courage to follow your example and let me speak, let me address my Canadian fellow citizens. Surprisingly, due to the internet and to your courage, I was able to address New Zealanders before I could address my fellow Canadians. And that is somewhat an embarrassment for my country. And I suppose that that is going to weigh heavily on the reputation of the Canadian media, which is abysmal.
Well, I share that embarrassment. Do you know how many alternative radio hosts and filmmakers there are in New Zealand that do 5 days a week?
Probably zero.
No, there's one.
Yes. Right. Outside of you, yes.
Yeah. There's 4 million New Zealanders, and there's only one Vinnie Eastwood. And just like you, that doesn't make me proud of what I'm accomplishing. It makes me ashamed of my countrymen.
I hear you. And in fact, my shame to carry a Canadian passport and a Romanian passport, because I'm Romanian by birth, has resulted in me abdicating both my Canadian and Romanian citizenship. I returned my passports to the respective heads of state. However, Romania has kept my passport, has not even acknowledged receipt of it, but has not mentioned anything. Canada could not keep my passport because the United Nations prevents governments from taking away or accepting, you know, citizens' citizenship unless that citizen has been accepted by another country. So because they don't want stateless people, you know, floating around with no status from one country to country. But for all intents and purposes, I gave up my Canadian citizenship and my Romanian citizenship because I'm ashamed of these countries. You know, I came to Canada in 1985, and because I had high respect for this country. That respect has completely evaporated because the country that I immigrated to no longer exists. The rule of law, respect for human rights, and democratic processes have been completely eviscerated in Canada. Canada is now a phony democracy, just like any other democracy in the world. And I explain that in my work, especially the series of articles that I've mentioned, Survival or Extinction, which will become a book probably in about 3 months' time. But to go back to the subject at hand, the global depopulation policy, we came to a break and while I was in the middle of my short list of the tragedy to come. And within this short list, I was describing how the global depopulation policy has saved us from nuclear annihilation, mass starvation, and environmental devastation, but that if continuing with these covert methods will result in the annihilation of humanity. So this list is a list of projections and estimates for the next 100 years as to what will happen if these covert methods continue, which they can't. So I mentioned that two out of four women worldwide will be infertile by 2050, 3 out of 4 by 2100. 2 billion genetic lines will be terminated by 2050 and 4 billion by 2100. The IQ will be lowered worldwide from an average of 90, which is where it is today, to an average of about 70 by 2050 and to an average of about 50 by 2100. Which means that the majority of the population will be, for all intents and purposes, mentally retarded. So that will be, mental retardation will be the norm rather than exception. Of course, in the Western world, we see an ever greater number of the population or segment of the population being, you know, intellectually incapable of functioning. And that's the result of...
Anybody who watches Mark Dice's videos where he goes around and asks people simple questions would think that that is happening already.
Well, sure. Of course it's happening. This is why everything is being dumbed down. This is why now the curriculum of in school is 2 years from what it was 50 years ago, 2 years behind what it was 50 years ago. So there's no doubt that there has been a huge deterioration in the mental aptitude of the Western world. And that is also visible in the fact that the incidence of genius among children in China is 3 times higher now than it is in children in the Western world. And that could have not always been the case, simply because our scientific and technological advantage would have come from our intellectual ability. And we would not have had this or gained this intellectual, this scientific and technological advantage had we not been at par intellectually with the Chinese. That is no longer the case. And why is that no longer the case? Because for the past 68 years, our children, us, we have been subjected to chemical and biological poisons that have altered and undermined our genetic and intellectual endowment. And this is the result of that. And it cannot continue. If it continues, we will all be retarded in a century or so. Now, to continue with the list, that's where we were left before the break. Half the population will be sexually confused. Now we have an incidence of about 15% of the population being sexually confused. That is to say, is one either, you know, lesbian, homosexual, bisexual, or transsexual. Now, the normal or incidence of aberrant sexual behavior, if you want, is about 3 to 4%. Now, of course, because Western society, Western nations have been subjected to these chemical poisons, the occurrence of sexual confusion is now around 15%, so 3 to 4 times higher than normally. Half of the world's children will suffer from developmental disorders. By the end of the 21st century, if this nonsense continues. 9 out of 10 people worldwide will have severely damaged endocrine systems, resulting in chronic illness in at least 3/4 of the population. Now we have chronic illness in about 25% of the population, that is to say 1/4 of the population. But as I said, the damage is cumulative and it is greater from generation to generation. Life expectancy will sink from an average of 70 years today, which is what it is worldwide, to 60 years by 2050, and to 50 years by 2100. We already see this kind of shortening of the lifespan in countries like the Soviet Union, in Russia, where over the past 20 years, the lifespan, especially among males, has gone down from, I think it was at 71, has gone down to about 54.
I spoke to a Russian about that, and they said it's unsurprising because I think they even had to institute a minimum price for vodka. It's about $1 a bottle of vodka, right? That's how cheap it is, and there's an extraordinary amount of vodka being drank, extraordinarily amount of cigarettes being smoked. Because there ain't no employment opportunities in a large part for the population of Russia, and as a result, there's this social degradation that has a real physical effect on the body, and that affects the life expectancy massively.
Yes, and of course, alcohol in Russia has been deliberately pushed, and the price has been made so cheap, and it's cheaper than water, basically, or pop. This has been deliberate in order to undermine human health and to shorten lifespans, which is in tune with the goals of the global depopulation policy. Now, Russia has chosen alcohol, China has chosen tobacco to achieve the same goal, and of course the West has chosen drugs to do that. And I describe that in my book for anybody who is interested in details. But the last point on my short list here is that 9 out of 10 males worldwide will have useless sperm by the end of the 21st century if this methodology continues. That is what we're facing. If we think that we can continue with the deception and choose, you know, the easy way out by avoiding to confront the overpopulation problem and doing our part voluntarily rather than being forced upon us through through covert methods. So one way or another, we're going to pay a price. Whether we want to admit it or not, we will pay a price, and the price will be irrevocable and will annihilate us if we continue to close our eyes and pretend that this is going to go away. This problem is not going away. One way or another, we're going to be dead. Whether we address this problem openly, whether we succeed in addressing this problem openly, will decide whether we survive as a species or we're going to go the way of the dinosaurs. So now I want to start talking about in greater detail about the consequences, the direct, indirect, and unintended consequences of the covert methods of depopulation.
Or as I call it, the unintended consequences, where there are layers upon layers of unintended consequences. Yes.
Which is actually what we'll be doing. We will be peeling the layers from this stinky onion, which is the global depopulation policy.
Well, let's hope it doesn't make us cry. Go for your life.
It'll certainly bring tears to our eyes. I feel sorry for people who are listening to this for the first time and who are hearing that such a thing as a global depopulation policy exists, and they're hearing that, you know, from my mouth by listening to this interview for the first time, because this is a shock, a body blow of major proportions that will completely alter somebody's view of the world and destroy, you know, the illusion that we live in a society that is free and democratic. That is certainly not the case, and it's not because our leaders have intentionally tried, you know, to usurp our democratic rights. It's because we are dealing with a program of global proportions to solve, you know, problems that are global and that eschew easy solutions. This is, you know, has grown step by step, and we are in this mess because we have refused to look at the hard facts and to face the bitter reality. Now, people who are listening to me now will be facing the bitter reality because I present the facts unadulterated, as they are, as painful as they are, and without, you know, considering people's sensitivities, be they religious or political or moral. The facts are what they are, and unless we confront them head on, we are all doomed. Now, the consequences. We reap what we sow. This wisdom, you know, cannot be ignored. There is hardly an aspect of our lives that is not affected in one way or another by the necessities of the global depopulation policy. And there is hardly a person on the planet who is not touched both directly and indirectly by the measures of depopulation, regardless of where you live. The only people who can really claim to be outside the reach of the global depopulation policy are the isolated tribes of the Amazon and other such scattered people living in remote and inaccessible parts of the globe, far away from civilization. So let's start with the direct consequences. Now, obviously, any attempt at social engineering will have a cascading effect, and some effects will be expected and others unexpected. One of the most obvious effects of implementing a secret, covert policy that undermines our reproductive freedom and subverts our fertility is that the governments that we have in place now are, for all intents and purposes, illegitimate governments and false democracies. Now, a policy that can only be implemented in secret and against the will of the people will obviously, by necessity, require bypassing the democratic process. Because voters would never give their consent to their governments to poison them to infertility and to chronic and debilitating illness, they would never agree to that. They would never give governments the consent to do that.
Unless the government lies to them and tells them that the poisons and so forth that they're giving them are good for their teeth.
For your teeth, yes, of course. And that's how they've been getting away with it. And I will discuss that under the section of the ethical consequences of this policy, because that's where it properly belongs. Now, governments exist to ensure the security of the people, not to subvert it. And obviously, by poisoning our environment, our basic elements of life, you know, food and water, in order to subvert our reproductive rights and our human fertility, it is with dire consequences for our health and to our lives is obviously not ensuring our security, but subverting our security. So the global depopulation policy has turned the role of government upside down, because it has annihilated the social contract that exists between the voters, between the electorate, and the politicians and the leadership. And this has rendered every Western government that perversely claims to be democratic the very opposite. It is not democratic. This is not democracy. This means that since 1945, because this policy has been in effect since 1945, and it has been spreading, you know, by leaps and bounds since 1950 in its methodology, that means that since 1945, the world has not known democracy, but only the illusion of democracy, and a perverted one at that.
Of course, the meaning of democracy derived from the Latin, demos means the mob, and kresi means rule, so it's mob rule. So I disagree. I think we have had mob rule for quite some time.
Well, this, you know, these decisions that have enabled the global depopulation policy have definitely not been made by the mob, but by elites. And I explain why that came to be and why that was the only way that was the only way possible in my next book.
Of course. However, mob rule is usually established because a demagogue manipulates the mob into making a decision, and that's our crowd psychology working in there. But yes, I'm sorry. Continue.
Sure. If it's done, you know, with ill intent, then it's manipulation. If it's done with good intent, then it is persuasion. So it's a degree of semantics there as well. What is the second political consequence that derives from this policy? Well, it's the abnegation of the rule of law and structural violence. That is to say, there is no rule of law. We cannot speak of the rule of law when we live in the middle of a genocide. We are at the receiving end of a genocide. Of course, genocide is a crime against humanity, and to speak that, to pretend that there is a rule of law while at the same time our governments are subjecting us to, you know, genocidal methods of population control is ridiculous. This is obviously not possible. The government cannot engage in genocide against us while at the same time maintaining that it preserves the rule of law. That is not the case. And since legality is the basis of legitimacy, any government that does not follow the rule of law is not legitimate. And the depopulation policy is grossly outside the law.
May I say that it shouldn't be governed by whether the legality, it should be governed rather by morality.
Sure. But ultimately, rules and laws are rooted in morality. Of course, the situation, the problem, the threat to our survival is so great that it was deemed necessary to bypass, to even ignore morality in order to address this. And it was done. They've tried to do it now in the most morally acceptable way possible, which is why they've, from the very beginning, they've consulted with religious authorities. And the religious authorities have said, you know, in those secret conversations, that we will not accept any kind of abortion, which is, you know, killing a fetus, killing a human being after conception, whether it's in the womb or not, whether it's 2 weeks after conception or 4 weeks after conception or 3 months after conception. Religious authorities have always been dead set against abortion, right? So, but they have in secret allowed governments to prevent, to undermine fertility, so that, in other words, you prevent the birth of new people into the world, the birth of children, before the moment of conception. And this is done by undermining our fertility. And this is why this was the only way that was acceptable to religious authorities, and especially to the Catholic Church. And the sign that the Catholic Church, which was the, you know, the last remaining obstacle to the depopulation policy in the West, is evident in a in an encyclical letter published in 1969 by the Vatican. It is called Humanae Vitae, which means human life. And in this encyclical letter, there is one paragraph which betrays the fact that the Vatican has given its tacit go-ahead to secular authorities to poison our reproductive system in order to prevent the birth of children, so that we wouldn't have to resort to abortion, or at least that would be, you know, a point of last resort. It would be the exception rather than the rule. Whereas in China, where there were no religious obstacles to overcome, the government now prevents the birth of new children simply by aborting fetuses. That is done. Every Chinese woman has undergoes abortion once or twice in her lifetime. The numbers are there for everybody to see. They did not have to go behind people's backs and say, well, you know, we have moral impediments and we have legal impediments and democracy stands in the way, therefore, you know, we're going to proceed covertly. They could do it overtly by simply making a law saying that from now on, everybody is allowed only one child. And but in so doing, they have overtly addressed the population problem, and they have not needed to subject their people to covert poisoning. So even though you know, what is the greater moral crime here, to abort or to subject the entire human population to poisons that undermine the intellectual and genetic endowment of humanity? In other words, the damage you do in the long term by refusing to address this problem through legal, open ways is far greater than the damage that is done, you know, by aborting, by actually killing a fetus. The problem of oral population represents. It represents moral dilemmas that, however you cut it, whatever method you choose, you're going to have to confront, you know, very ugly realities. Whether it is abortion, if you do it openly, as the Chinese do, through the law, or whether it is, you know, damaging the genetic and intellectual endowment of the entire race, which is the end result of covert methods. What is the greater evil? They both methods, you know, both solutions entail a degree of evil, if you want. Unless people have the self-restraint, if you want, to ensure that they don't, you know, get pregnant, they don't have to resort to abortion. That, in other words, they use the natural cycles in order to prevent the natural fertility cycles in order to prevent impregnating women. So, and this is, of course, what the Church has insisted on, especially the Catholic Church, you know, has insisted on as the only morally acceptable solution. But, of course, it doesn't work because...
Yes, well, I don't think the Catholic Church and the Vatican, which is responsible probably for more pedophilia than any other single organization on earth, can still crown themselves as the pinnacle of morality.
Well, that subject aside, the pedophilia, you know, theoretically, yes, this is the only acceptable alternative. That is, you know, exercise self-restraint, only have sex during the times when the woman is infertile, and so on. But in reality, in practice, it is not working because the sexual drive is so powerful that nobody can resist, and sure as hell, young people can't resist it. So,
well, maybe back in the day it was possible, but now we have 24-hour pornography to contend with. We have sexual videos and what. In fact, at the same time as the New World Order is encouraging people, whether by chemical or propagandistic means, to not have children, they are encouraging through the media and our current, I don't know, morally depraved society, I think would probably be an apt way to describe it, to have a propensity for sexual pleasure at any time, day or night. That's basically what it is. You've turned life into, instead of morality and responsibility, into amorality and sexuality being the domineering principles that are guiding our lives.
Well, you know, the sexually explicit nature of our society has also been socially engineered. And why? Because they realize that in order to if people are going to exercise self restraint, that is to say, if they're going to have small families, they need to have sexual releases, you know, without resulting in pregnancy. So this is why I suspect pornography has been allowed, you know, to flourish, in order to provide people with the possibility of sexual release that does not result in pregnancy. That too is a consequence of the global depopulation policy, at least of its initial attempts to decide, you know, on what kind of methodology to employ or not to employ.
Is it not ironic that nowadays we're meeting somebody for the first night and having sex with them after taking home from a bar produces less children than a society previously where you had to wait till marriage before you could conceive?
Yeah, but that is so because our fertility is completely substandard. And the reason it is completely substandard is because we are being poisoned, chronically poisoned at low levels throughout the duration of our lifetimes from multiple sources: water, food, and so on, beverages. This is not because you know, because we are using now condoms faithfully. It is because literally we are just not as fertile as we should be naturally. Now, to go back to the destruction of the rule of law and structural violence. Well, now obviously the global depopulation policy constitutes crimes against humanity and genocide, for better or worse. And this has made the administration of justice illegal and the authority of the state ill-gained. Why? Because the state, the very state that pretends to uphold the rule of law, subverts it in the most significant right, the right to life. So if while they're subverting our right to life and our reproductive rights, they're pretending to maintain, you know, all of the other rights, including the right to life. So it is they're lying to our faces, and they have absolutely no justification, no legal justification, no legitimacy to be in control of the administration of justice, because they themselves violate justice in the most egregious manner, in the most fundamental right, which is the right to life. That is another paradox of our society. So, in other words, our Western societies now, through the covert methods of depopulation, are committing structural violence on a of a dimension hitherto unknown. This has never been this kind of across the board crimes have never been committed before. Not even by the Nazis. Not even by Hitler. Who, you know, selected 7 million Jews and put them in concentration camps, but these 7 million Jews constituted a very, very small percentage of the population. Of course, what they've done to the Jewish people in the concentration camps during the Second World War and to the Gypsies is completely unthinkable today. But nevertheless, what is being done today to the entire spectrum of the population, to all of us, It is structural violence at an unprecedented level, although, of course, with a very, very small level of cruelty. So we've eliminated the cruelty, but the structural violence is greater than ever before.
It's perception management, more or less. If you don't know that you're a slave, you never lust for greater freedoms. And I think this is what the population has been conditioned into believing, is that slavery is freedom. And people who question the current slavery paradigm are crazy.
Well, it's not that, Vinny, it's not that the authorities don't want us to have as much freedom as we possibly can. But the reality is that any kind of social construct demands the abdication of absolute personal freedom for the common good, for collective interests.
May I say, there's two ways of actually looking at that. One is I abdicate my personal freedom for the greater good. Say, for example, I do this radio show for the greater good. I could have the freedom to go out and, do some other kind of stuff instead. However, I'm not being forced to give up my freedom in order to do this. I am actually volunteering to give up my freedom without somebody telling me because my morality compels me to do so. It is the moral obligation, I believe, that is a far superior form of servitude because you impose it upon yourself for the right reasons to serve humanity rather than somebody else taking it away from you for the wrong reasons.
Yes. And this is the solution to turning this thing around from covert methods to overt legislation. This is the solution. The truth has to be allowed to reign supreme. People have to know what the facts are, what the bitter realities are. And then knowing the lack of choices, they will come, you know, to the only logical conclusion which we have to assume personal responsibility over this. We have to be in the driving seat of this depopulation policy. In other words, we have to control it, and we have to control it in our own bedrooms, in our own families, on a personal level.
Yeah, and there was a policy, I think, if you want to sustain, you need to plant three times as much as you cut down, kind of thing. I forget whose principle that was. It might have been Native Americans, I think, where they would cut down a tree in order to use the wood, but in so doing, they would always plant three seedlings per tree that they cut down. And as a result, the natural environment would always grow back just as much as they took, if not more. And nowadays, we plant nothing from what we take. And it's almost like the world is a microcosm of the Easter Island phenomenon when there are no trees left.
Well, there has been a paradigm change, in the 1980s. And this paradigm change has resulted in documents and plans such as Agenda 21, which is, you know, completely vilified nowadays, and the Millennium Development Goals. But this is the reality of it. In order to rectify all of these, you know, these combined problems that we have brought onto the world, we are paying for the sins of our fathers, if you want. We're paying for the sins of civilization. Now we've realized that we've reached the end of nature, and the only way to come back to a situation of where human civilization is in balance with nature is to solve these problems, to solve, you know, the problem of overconsumption, of overpopulation, and so on. And Agenda 21 and the Millennium Development Goals are the roadmap to solving these problems. And of course, it's bitter medicine. Everybody hates it because it's bitter medicine. It's very, very difficult to pay for your own sins, let alone for the sins of your fathers. And now we're paying for the sins of our fathers and our forefathers. But there's no other way. If we don't make this sacrifice, if our generation doesn't make this sacrifice, there will be no other generations after us. They will be left with a denuded world with absolutely no resources and no clean air to breathe, and they will be killing each other because there's going to be nothing left.
It reminds me, the term sacrifice, like, I think sacrifice is really only highly valued if it's self-sacrifice. Sacrificing everybody else because I want a society such and such and what have you, I think that's going in the wrong direction. It's forcing, like the Aztecs, for example, sacrificing people on top of a pyramid and throwing the headless bodies down the way. That's not like, oh, it's a moral, ethical sacrifice. You know, it's going to be good. It's going to be fabulous. Everybody's going to be happy because they're dead because we sacrificed them to our gods. Whereas self-sacrifice, people who actually go willing, people who behave selflessly, tends to have far greater effect. And indeed, it inspires self-sacrifice in others.
This is a very, very intelligent comment, Vinny. It's an extraordinarily intelligent comment. And I've come to the same conclusion. This is why I keep saying what we need is not a new global order. What we need is a new axial age. We need, you know, an awakening in our moral sentiment, in our a reawakening of our values. And we need to live in the image of God now more than ever before. And I'm saying that, and I'm not even religious. You know, I've come to this conclusion as an agnostic. Why? Because the only way to make these sacrifices that we need to make for our children, for future generations, for the planet, the only way that we are going to accept paying for the sins of our fathers is if we have this humility that comes, you know, from our religious education. Religion has endowed us with this humility, the humility to make sacrifices for others, right? And society cannot thrive. And now we know better than ever before that society cannot exist, cannot continue unless human beings are willing to make this. And of course, religions in the past have inculcated those values in us, and now they're kind of dormant. You know, we have not used them. We've expected the system, we've expected the scientific fixes to solve what are primarily moral problems, to solve social problems. Social problems cannot be solved through scientific and technical fixes. They can merely be postponed, but they cannot be solved. And we have come to this realization. Actually, the science czar of the Obama administration, his name is Dr. Holdren. He has so much as said this. They have admitted this publicly now, which is the first time ever. And of course, without spelling out the entire truth, they've said, you know, we cannot, science cannot fix our problems. Of course, you know, they did not say that science cannot fix our overpopulation problems, but this is what they meant. And now they're going, you know, from behind the scenes, from one government to another, looking for an alternative solution. And, of course, I have provided that alternative solution. It's called the Ulm Principles. But this alternative solution cannot happen unless people are energized and unless people embrace it and they make the necessary sacrifices, which requires self-sacrifice, which requires knowledge, which requires the truth. You know, there has to be a cascading effect. First, if you want to change this from covert to overt, from taking the responsibility from the hands of elites and governments and put it in the hands of the people, on people's shoulders and distribute it equally, people have to have the knowledge. In order to acquire the knowledge and the facts, they need to know the truth. And the truth is not being allowed out right now. You know, all our media outlets are designed and geared towards feeding us, you know, more lies and manufacturing consent in order to keep the illusion going, keep the deception going, keep the con going. But they know, the people at the top, they realize that, you know, this con, this deception has worked for 68 years, but it's no longer possible. We can no longer continue with this because we're going to kill each other. You know, there's still this segment of the scientific community which believes that GMOs are going to solve all our problems. Like, in other words, they're going to undermine our fertility without undermining our health. But that is another pipe dream because we don't know. We just don't know what GMOs, what the long-term effect of genetically modified organisms will be. And I can guarantee you it's not going to be pretty. Because every time you interfere with a normal functioning of the human body, you're going to have negative side effects. That is a law of nature. It's just the way it is. The organism, the human organism, it is perfect the way it is, right? If you're going to try and shift this to there or undermine this, you're going to cause God knows, you know, what kind of repercussions within the normal functioning of the body. There's always going to be long-term effects when you start fiddling with a normal function of the body. Mm. And of course, the function to procreate is vital to the survival of the species. You know, so if you undermine the sexual, reproductive system, you are doing extraordinary damage to the entire human body. That much is certain. Mm. It doesn't matter how you approach it.
Well, I liken this this kind of thing between the self-sacrifice and sacrifice that we were talking about before. It's kind of like you're in the kitchen and you're doing the dishes, and your child comes up and says, "You're doing the dishes wrong. You gotta use more soap, or you gotta scrub it better, or something of that nature." And then, as a parent, you go, "How about this? You do the dishes, right? If it ain't being done right, you've got to do it yourself." And that's precisely what the government avoids at every possible turn of doing it. Because if people learned that they could do everything themselves, they would be out of the job.
Yes.
And I said on Facebook the other day that a politician's job is not to solve problems. It is to create a crisis to facilitate their continued employment.
Well, no, in all fairness, Vinny, you know, this went underground, this policy went underground, and many of the policies that went along with globalization, which are intended ultimately to maintain international peace and to achieve universal prosperity, because there were structural and systemic obstacles that stood in the way. There were also cultural obstacles. There are also still religious obstacles that stand in the way. You know, it was not done with the intention to screw us. That's not the case. It has developed that way simply by the necessity to evade all of these obstacles, to find a way, you know, to go around all of these obstacles without having to confront them, because it was easier to go around them rather than confront them. And it's true. It was just simply not possible to approach it any other way in 1945, right? And in many ways today, in some conservative societies, it's still not possible today, which is why the secrecy is maintained.
Perhaps the reason why they came up with this in 1945 is because they'd just come out of World War II, a massive crisis, and mm-hmm. then once a crisis rears itself, you yeah. justify anything. Anything yeah. gets justified in the face of a crisis. Desperate times call for what?
Desperate measure. Yes, and it was a propitious environment. I mean, this is why they first tested these methods on the Axis powers and the losing powers, on Japan, Italy, and Germany, which is why, and I've discussed that, I think, in the last interview, which is why Germany, Japan, and Italy are the ones who have gone through the demographic transition first. Now they are the ones who have first reach a population pyramid which has more old people than they have young people. And that is why they have all of these, they're facing these economic problems the first, right? We are right behind them. We're going to face the exact same economic problems within 10, 15 years. The reason we're behind them is because, you know, our population is still growing. It's not decreasing yet due to immigration. But we are, you know, high immigration countries because we are in the new world, Canada, the United States, New Zealand, Australia. So we are about 15 years behind them. Japan was the first to reach, you know, the fourth stage of the demographic transition, where they have more old people than they have young people. Luckily, they have very high personal savings, but still, now they're running out of, you know, there's nobody to take care of the old. Germany is the second one, with 24% old people and about the same number of same percentage of young people. Italy is the third one. So the Axis powers are the first to have reached stage level of the demographic transitions because they were first to have been subjected to covert methods of population control. And they were first subjected to this because there was no moral impediment. I mean, they were guinea pigs because they had lost the war, and now they're at the mercy of the Allied powers, and the Allied powers could impose whatever solutions they wanted on the losing powers, and that's exactly what they did. And having tested them on the Axis powers, then they realized they worked really well. So then, in the early 1950s, they started employing them on their own people, as I described in my book, you know, in a tit for tat fashion, by between the communist camp and the capitalist camp. So you do one country, we'll do the other.
Yeah, it reminds me of a quote from Batman. I think it was The Dark Knight. It says, you either die the good guy or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain. And I think the Allied powers lived long enough to see themselves become the villain.
Yes. And this is the difficulty and the burden of responsibility. Imagine. It is difficult to be the head of a family, a father. As a father, you have responsibilities, right? As a mayor, you have responsibilities towards the entire city. As a president or a prime minister, you have responsibility to an entire country, millions of people. But now the United Nations, which is there in charge, you know, of organizing, cooperating this global depopulation policy and the entire globalization process, they are responsible for the entire world, for 7 billion people. The burden of responsibility is so great that, you know, I would not want to be in the shoes of these people. And yet somebody has to have that responsibility. Somebody has to make decisions of life and death, of poverty and wealth, of illness and good health. That's how difficult it is. This is the burden of power, the burden of responsibility. There's no other way.
And ironically, none of those people who have unchecked power are using it responsibly. And I think that responsibility, that the pyramid has been inverted, okay? It's supposed to be lots of individual responsibility, and then maybe a little bit of collective responsibility. It has now become virtually no individual responsibility, and overarching, overwhelming collective responsibilities that are imposed upon us by others.
Yeah, but, you know, again, this has resulted because we have these humongous structures. In order to coordinate a plan of attack, if you want, globally, we've had to put together these global organizations, these structures that are mammoth bureaucracies. Well, mammoth bureaucracies like the United Nations and its agencies, you know, like the World Health Organization, like UNESCO and so on, like the United Nations Development Fund, who are in charge, you know, of one aspect of the globalization plan or another, are mammoth bureaucracies. A mammoth bureaucracy is very, very, very sluggish. It's very rigid. It's not reactive and flexible like a single human being would be.
There's no diversity of decision-making processes. Yes.
But also because any kind of decision has to be done by consensus, okay? And to reach consensus in this huge bureaucracy between all of these players, these stakeholders, it's extremely difficult. It takes time. So any kind of decision takes time to make because you need consensus to make it, and then it takes time to diffuse it. It takes time to put it into action because you have to apportion, you know, all kinds of functions to the outer layers of the organization until it, you know, it percolates and perpetrates throughout society to accomplish the goal that was decided upon. So it is the size of the bureaucracies today that inhibit decision-making process, that make it also so apparently so inhumane. It's not because the will is not there to be humane. The will is there. I can guarantee you that. It's just that the ability, you know, to make these decisions on a global level and to apply them, to implement them on a global level, is so excruciatingly difficult. And they're working with broad strokes. They're working with macroeconomic tools. And, of course, macroeconomic tools is like painting a corner with a 10-inch brush. It's going to be messy. It's going to be leaking all over the place, right? And people are going to suffer. You cannot be humane when you're working with macroeconomic tools. And that's all they have at their disposal. This is why, you know, the United Nations works from the top with their macroeconomic tools and this difficult process of consensus. And then from the bottom, we have the cleanup crew. And the cleanup crew, if you want, of all the mess, you know, of these macro tools are all the religious organizations, especially the Catholic Church, you know, with all of its hospitals and shelters and so on. Because so many people are forgotten, are left behind by these macroeconomic tools. And somebody has to, you know, to provide support from the bottom up. And this is where the Catholic Church has an extraordinarily important function to play. And, you know, love it or hate it, and now, of course, it's being attacked from every corner. They are the cleanup crew. They're doing the dirty work on the ground, you know. They are fixing all of the problems. They are wiping the tears, you know, of all of those who are forgotten and who have been brushed aside and who have been hurt and harmed by macroeconomic tools.
Don't you find that ironic, though, is that the problem has been caused by a collectivist bureaucracy to which the Catholic Church is simply one of them, but it has different goals. However, the fact that it is, again, a collectivist bureaucracy means it will not actually ever solve the problem, and indeed it will continue to make all of those people who have been left out of the system, left out in the cold by the system, will never actually obtain anything independence, because it's either one form of collective bureaucracy that fails you or another form of collective bureaucracy that you're completely dependent on when the other one fails. And it means that people are never and shall never be independent at all.
Well, this is why having this understanding, having come to this understanding, this wisdom, if you want, you know, through so many generations of social coexistence, now we know that we have to have these bureaucracies in place because we cannot coordinate these giant global plans. But at the same time, we have to give the individual a level of responsibility and flexibility so that he can be humane within these inhumane bureaucracies. And this is what my work now consists of, designing just that, you know, designing a political and an institutional structure that allows global coordination while at the same time allows personal responsibility and flexibility, so that we can wipe the tears of those who are being forgotten and run over by these macroeconomic tools. Mm. You know, we're learning. This is the very first time. And now this is why I'm going into politics now, because I think I have a contribution to make in this respect. And also because I'm you know, the very first one to be able to say all of these things. Everybody else is hiding the truth because they're afraid. They're afraid that if they come forward and they say this, they're not going to be elected, or they're going to lose their position within the system, or they're going to be punished. You know, they're not going to advance, or they're going to lose their employment altogether, and they're going to be starving to death, and their kids will have nothing.
Mm.
Everybody's handicapped by fear because personal responsibility has been robbed, has been taken away from us by these giant bureaucracies.
It's been done so systematically so that we didn't even notice. And then it's kind of like the Jefferson quote. He said, what was it? The bank should never have the power to issue the people's currency, because if they do, they will, through inflation and then deflation, deprive the people of their private property, and will one day they will all wake up homeless on the continent their forefathers conquered. And I think if we look at that not just in a banking sense, but in a personal responsibility or an individualistic freedom sense, we cannot allow international bureaucracies to determine what our freedoms can be, because via inflation and then deflation of their freedoms, they will wind up everybody being absolutely slaves in a world that their forefathers settled.
Well, this is why I say that you're very, very true in what you're saying, very right. This is why I say that to move forward into the future, we now have to divest, if you want, the elites of much authority, simply by taking over many of their responsibilities, so that we address those problems, you know, not from the top down, but from the bottom up.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
In order to do that, we need to educate the publics, and we need the truth to reign supreme. We need to be able to speak the truth. Because people, you know, it doesn't matter whether they are intellectually astute or not, they will get it. One way or another, they will get it. If they don't get it intellectually, they'll get it emotionally, they'll get it emotionally, exactly.
This wake-up process is a very emotional one indeed. I can't tell you how many nights I have virtually cried myself to sleep and felt this pain, this loss. It's like losing a loved one. Oh, I loved my collectivism. I loved my slavery because I was taught over my entire life to appreciate it and think that it was absolutely necessary, that I couldn't survive without it. And then you feel that loss. And you eventually have to learn that everything that you ever thought you would become, all of your life lessons and everything, you have to learn them all over again.
Yes, and you go through a tremendous sense of loss, but also to a tremendous amount of anger. And in order to get over the anger, you know, because you just want to kill people, you know, you want to kill everybody in power. That's your first reaction when you realize that, you know, you're at the end of all these cruel methods. But once you start to understand how this has come to be, that we are all victims of this, we're all trapped, you know, in this system, that you know, nobody can be blamed to the extent that we'll say, yeah, we're going to scapegoat that person or that person, you know, it's their fault. Because it doesn't matter who gets to a position of authority, we'll confront the exact same issues, and we'll be limited to the exact same methods, unless the people take responsibility, and you know, there's going to be a tremendous awakening, so that everything can be done, can be addressed, all these problems can be addressed from the bottom up and not just from the top down.
Indeed. Loss, then anger, and finally empowerment, ladies and gentlemen. This is the end of the second hour with my very special guest, Kevin Galilee, and we will be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Don't you go anywhere, folks.